Blog Talk Radio. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Couple Speak Relationship Forum. I'm your host, Susan Lager, a psychotherapist and relationship coach at the Couple Center and Couple Speak in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where I broadcast live monthly on Wednesdays, usually at about 8:30 p.m. Tonight's episode, August 15th, 2012, is about a very, very important topic, I think, to anyone who has ever been or is now in a close relationship where they think they have a future and they hope for a future. The name of the episode is called How Love Is Not Enough, Six Critical Factors to Evaluate. I'll be talking about the myths and lies we tell ourselves in intimate partnerships and how we put up with all kinds of bull in the name of love. And you, my callers and listeners, are my co-hosts tonight. So call in live at toll-free 877-497-9046 with questions, comments, stories, or just your two cents. I really welcome any input because I don't like talking to myself with myself. In any event, one brief technical issue. If you want to share a question or a comment, just press 1 and you'll be in line to join me on the air. And don't be shy. Nobody can see you. What I'll do, I think, is I'll take questions at a few different intervals throughout the show so that if you have a question, you don't feel like you're sitting on it for a long time, but also so that I can preserve the flow of the topics. I want to start by telling you that in my work as a psychotherapist and a coach, I will often hear clients and friends lamenting the fact that their partners love them, but that they feel chronically miserable in their relationships. And this is a very common theme that I experience in my work and in my personal life. And I would like to share some anecdotal examples of this that I think will give you really a sense of how this plays out for different people in different ways. So I'm going to give you anecdotal examples, and they're masked for purposes of confidentiality or privacy. I don't think you'll recognize yourself or anybody else in these. Here's the first example. My husband cares deeply about me, but has never, ever apologized for his 3-year affair or for anything else he's ever done to hurt me. He doesn't feel any empathy for me. I'd leave him, but I love him, and I think he loves me in his own convoluted way. Deep down, I think he really loves me. This is a very common one. I've seen this one with quite a bit of frequency in my work where there's no apology, and there's major transgression. There's a betrayal of trust, something that really violates the agreements of the relationship, and it goes kind of unchecked. And the partner sort of banks on the fact that it will be swept under the rug and it's forgotten. Here's another one. I love my girlfriend. We've been together for years and have made a life together, but she's totally dismissive about my need for intimacy, won't discuss it, and won't go to counseling together, even though I've always tried my best to be loving, kind, and tuned into her. At this point, we never make love or have any real physical intimacy of any kind. She doesn't seem to care about how much loneliness and despair this causes me, but I know deep down she loves me, so it's hard to even imagine breaking up. This is another very common theme in my work, especially where one person has set the tone for the intimacy pattern, and they're not particularly concerned about it. They don't want to look at it. It doesn't bother them, so we're not going to talk about it. And the other person puts up with it because there's a feeling that somewhere deep down there's mutual love. Here's another example. My husband is unbelievably controlling. He's the main provider in the family, but even though I'm a full-time mom for our three kids and work 12 hours a week at my job, he gives me a, quote, allowance, which is really measly. He expects me to use all the money I earn to pay for stuff for our children. He's secretive about the checkbook and our funds. He buys himself big toys like motorcycles and fancy tools, but begrudges me getting a decent haircut or even joining a gym. He makes me feel like a helpless child, but I do love him, and I think he loves me underneath it all, so I stay. Another very common theme in my work, where there's a complete imbalance of power. One person holds the purse strings and the other partner goes along. It's very often along gender lines. It's a very traditional kind of marriage. It's a throwback to, what, the 16th century, 17th century. And so it seems to work well enough for the person with the power, but the person who has no power kind of rationalizes it because there's some sense of caring. I'm wondering if any of these scenarios sound familiar to you. How, you know, are you now, or do you feel like you've ever been in a relationship where you stayed because of love, quote, love, even though you weren't being treated in loving ways? Do you feel like you make excuses for this partner and continually shortchange yourself? That's something I think you should look at. If so, I have a few questions I'd like you to think about before you invest more years in what I feel may be a dead relationship. Now, I want to preface this program by saying I am not advocating that just because you have any or all of these problems that the solution necessarily needs to be leaving, divorce, or separation. What I am saying is that it's really important for you to look at how you've sold out on yourself. Maybe you're accepting things that are unacceptable, and you've bought into some toxic patterns because you feel like deep down there's love. And I see one question already, so I'm going to take it. And let's see. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Susan.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Oh, well, I'm getting more upset by the second. How do these people know their significant other loves them if they don't show them that they love them?
Well, that's a complicated question, and you know, I could see how it would stir the pot for you. Often there's a sense
love should feel good.
Yeah, love should feel good most of the time, but often there's a memory of something better, or often there are moments of something more tender, something that feels sweeter, something that feels more open. And or even if it's not a sense that the partner loves them, the other part of this is that, well, I love my partner, and love means I should put up with this stuff, and I should just hang in there and just hope for something better. It
sounds like they're selling themselves pretty short.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. Now, do you know anybody, or have you experienced this in your partnership or your marriage? I mean, does this feel like it rings true on any of these levels for you?
Absolutely.
Which?
Absolutely. But the question is, why does one tolerate it? Why does one have to settle for crumbs when they can have the whole piece of the pie?
Well, that's a very complicated question. There are a lot of reasons, and I think if I had an extended show, I'd go into more of those reasons in depth. It often has to do with self-esteem, low self-esteem, or feelings of undeservingness. I just don't deserve any better. I don't like myself very much, so I'm lucky to get crumbs. Crumbs are probably the best that I can get. Often there,
or as you said before, it's a pattern you've gotten into.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely.
And you know what? Everything's not a struggle. Everything's not a fight.
Right.
You're not clawing your way all the time.
That's right.
You're resigned. You're resigned.
Yes, yes. And I think I'm glad you mentioned that, because these postures are characterized by a form of resignation and denial.
Yes.
People
nauseating.
Well, I'm trying not to judge it, but it really requires a certain level of sweeping things under the rug and rationalization and denial. And people kind of excusing their partners and a variety of behaviors because there's some supposed love there.
Well, you know what? You wouldn't excuse strangers, so why should you excuse those who are dearest to us?
Excellent point. Why would you have a different standard for in an intimate partnership and then we would for a close friend? Ideally, we wouldn't have a different standard. And one of the things that I think is I'll talk about in the program is looking at one's own part, and that's the first issue that I want to get to, that I think is really critical, looking at one's own part and how one is part of the maintenance of this kind of a system. It's a two-person dance. It requires two people to do this. And all it requires is one person to say, I refuse to tolerate this. This is not okay. We're either going to go to couples counseling or there are going to be consequences of one kind of another for this kind of behavior. But it does start with an internal sense of deserving. Now,
and one demonstrates bad behavior because one can and one is allowed to. But if one is not allowed to, that person has shown that I will not tolerate this type of behavior from anyone, particularly someone I'm cohabitating with who's supposed to make me feel good about myself.
Yes. Well, it's a collusion. It's a collusion. It takes two. And that will get to the first thing that I'm going to talk about in a moment, how we do the dance with our partners and we help set the stage. I want to thank you for your comments and questions. And I need to get to some more because there are some other people who want to share something. But if something comes up later, feel free to share, okay?
Okay, I'm going back to my asparagus and garden tomato sandwich.
There we go. Thank you, caller.
You're welcome.
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello.
Can you just say what your name is, caller? What's your name?
My name is Betty.
Okay. Hi, Betty.
Hi. And I'm wondering to what degree, if our expectations, if we're in a long-term relationship, and when our expectations are colored by abandonment issues from childhood, and we seem to be paralleling, same dynamics in a long-term relationship that has lasted even longer than the childhood relationship, there's like a sense of paralysis.
Mm-hmm. You're making a very good point.
And our expectations are actually fortified neurologically.
Well, you're making. I'm sorry.
Yeah, by our experience.
There are neural pathways that get created. Our brain gets trained very early into certain kinds of attachment patterns. So if we were chronically rejected growing up, we're kind of acclimated and conditioned for that. So it sets up a neural pathway. You bring up a very good point that makes very familiar and maybe not quite acceptable, but acceptable in the sense of familiar, sense of settling for less or accepting peanuts or being treated badly. And yes, you're right. It usually has to do with a repetition of some earlier, usually childhood, attachment sequence. We're repeating some kind of sequence that happened as a child or much, much younger. And we play it out unconsciously. That's part of the problem. And, I'm glad you raised that question because part of my aim in putting this show on is to help people become a little bit more conscious, that so much of this happens unconsciously and insidiously. It just kind of unfolds over time. It's not usually the first 2 weeks of a relationship. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right. So actually, we develop even more mastery at tolerating the intolerable. And the more we do that, it actually, I think the fears become magnified about what is the alternative.
Absolutely.
What Absolutely. Are the choices?
Yes, yes. This is putting up with things that are intolerable really requires a certain level of fear. It's often toxic beliefs about what would happen if you begin to stand up for yourself, if you begin to set limits. It's not predicated on a kind of on courage. It part of what fosters it is, I think you're right, fear about what else is out there, what else is available to me, will I ever find love again, is this the best I can do, etc. But that's an excellent point. And
in fact, if you're the over-responsible child, which develops from magical thinking as a child, and that is reinforced, or you reinforce that yourself within a long-term marriage, it's very difficult to know what is the alternative, or, you know, the alternative is, if I don't do it, there's going to be some sort of oblivion.
Yes.
Or death.
Yes, yes. That there's this big void out there. You're bringing up another important aspect of this, which is that often we are brought up to believe that our role is to be the fixer and the caregiver and the peacemaker. In certain families, that's a designated role. Women especially,
right.
Women especially. I have a colleague who talks about that very openly. She talks about tend and mend. That's very familiar territory, particularly for women. Now, this is not only women, though. I have worked with lots of men in my practice who are the tenders and the menders and the peacekeepers, and they put up with a lot of stuff, and they're basically allowing an abusive situation to unfold. So how
do you begin to, look at the other side of the fears that seem... So, you know, because there's no, it's like a black hole. The other side is like you fall off the edge of the universe or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a complicated question. I think it's important for people to begin to reality test their fear, to start to check it, to look at. One thing I encourage a lot of clients to do, and I do myself, is watch myself talk. Because often self-talk, the things we say to ourselves, it'll never get better, I'll never find, I'm not deserving, why bother, nothing I do makes a difference, stuff like that. That's often
good.
A window, the self-talk, negative, and that was my last show, negative thoughts, but self-talk is often a window into old toxic beliefs that are running the show. And
yeah,
I think,
very good.
You know, the simple answer to your question is that it's important for all of us in our relationships, our close relationships, to begin to challenge any toxic beliefs that are running the show and begin to do a reality check against them and look at, try to hear what they sound like. And very, very often you can get a sense of, what are you operating off of? And then to begin to do some reality checks to see, well, would a reasonable person agree with me about this? Is it possible that, I may not be, there may be This may not be entirely valid. So I think that's one beginning kind of way.
So cognitively really looking at your self-talk and maybe writing it down and identifying the pattern of toxic beliefs and begin
yes.
to challenge.
Yes. Yes. That's, I think that's
challenge,
one thing.
Is that
thing.
True? And what kind of pain does that reinforce or...
Right.
Yeah.
And what am I getting from it? Which gets to the first, one of the first six critical factors. One of the factors that I think is critical to look at is to evaluate whether or not you behave in ways which a reasonable person would see as clear contributors to your partner's unkind or unfair stance.
Like a reinforcement.
So, yeah, like what am I doing that is part of the system that keeps it going? Is there something on my end that really sets the stage for this or perpetuates this? And, you know, if so, to begin to explore ways to change your end of things before you decide that it's all your partner's fault. And what I see in my work all the time is that as you alter your own end of the dynamic, you will then see if your partner's behavior changes for the better. And if so, there may be hope for a happier kind of relationship. But my strong bias is that it begins by looking inward. What might I be doing that might be setting the stage for this? And I don't mean in a blaming way, accepting full responsibility, but looking at the system, that as one part of the system. The only, you know, one of the only parts that I can really change is me. And
yeah.
I think your comments speak to that. What might I be getting from it? What's my secondary gain? And people always look at me like I'm crazy when I say that, but all behavior serves some positive purpose. And
yeah, I've heard that we are what's called limbic athletes of self-criticism.
Wow, that's a good one. I like that. Yeah, we're very well trained. We're Olympians at that.
Yes.
And what might, you know, what is our investment in this system as it is? So if we have a partner who's very critical of us, what might we be doing to set the stage for that and to perpetuate that? And what do we get from it? That's a really important, I think a really important thing.
What do we get from it?
Yes. What do we get from it? And when I say a positive, there's usually a positive intent behind most behaviors. There's an attempt. Most of us don't start the day saying, let me think of a way to shoot myself in the foot today or
right.
make my own life miserable. We don't do that. Most reasonable people don't do that. But we are trying in some way to accomplish something. So let's say we're screaming at our partner a lot or blaming them a lot. We may be trying in a dysfunctional way to get their attention. And then the question becomes, how else can I do that so I don't contribute to a cycle of abusive language?
That's very good.
Okay?
Yes. Yes.
You know, it probably could be another whole show. I'm glad you listeners have raised these questions, callers, because this show just covers the things to look for that would be alerts for you, to alert you to whether or not you're settling into a very toxic pattern. Another whole show could be, all right, what to do about it. You know, unfortunately, in an hour show, there's just so much that we could cover. But thank you very much, listener. And again, if you have any further questions, feel free to share them. All right?
Thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome. The next thing, I think another critical factor that I think is important to look at is, does your partner show any concern at all for your feelings in a consistent way? And if the answer to that is no, then I would say your relationship may be characterized by what the therapists call empathic failure, And that is very bad. It doesn't bode well for future happiness or your physical or mental health. What it means is you're in a relationship where there's a consistent experience of your partner not tuning in to your feelings, your experience, your needs. They're kind of oblivious. And women very often will talk about feeling invisible. I hear that a lot in my work, feeling either invisible or erased. And it may be over something really small, like we're going out for the day, and my partner doesn't even ask me, well, what's your idea for the day? What do you want to do? It's very self-centered. It may be about something much larger, like one of the examples I gave where there's a partner who's had an affair or a partner who's breached trust in some significant way, and they're not curious about what was the impact on you about that. I know I screwed up. Tell me what your experience is about that. We all, in order to really truly feel love, we need to have a sense that there's concern for our internal experience. And without that, I think that is a pillar of a loving relationship. And when that can be limited and that can be expanded, but if that is consistently absent, I would recommend that you look at what am I doing in this relationship, and again, what might I be doing to inhibit empathy? Am I showing empathy so that I'm setting the stage for reciprocity? Am I not talking about my experience? That gets back to the first thing. Where am I in that loop? Am I just quiet and silent so my partner doesn't have a clue, and I'm allowing them to be in a very self-centered stance? But the empathic presence in a relationship is absolutely, absolutely critical. Another one is, does your partner have any handicap which limits their capacity to be close or trustworthy? Are you, for instance, married to or in a relationship, a long-term relationship, with a sociopath, someone who doesn't have concern for the rights and norms of society, the rights of others, the feelings of others, someone who is so hell-bent on getting what they want that they'll walk all over everybody to get their way? Are you with a rigid narcissist, someone who's so self-involved that they don't even see you, that all their energy is wrapped up in shoring up their own face? You know, narcissists are all about saving face. Or are you in a relationship with a very unrelated substance abuser? If so, you may be waiting for a miracle, in my opinion, in the name of love. In terms of the substance abuse thing, I don't think you're going to see any real potential playing out in a positive way as long as you're with a partner who is actively using, even if they're problematically, they may be not even drinking that much, but if it certainly looks problematic and played out and they're kind of anesthetizing themselves, you have wall between yourself and your partner, and that wall is anesthetizing them. So I characterize that as a behavioral handicap, not an inherent handicap. People could be more predisposed to certain behaviors, but that's sort of, and until that handicap be addressed, I don't think you're going to, that's going to time very loving to you. Again, the question is, well, you know, my partner does a lot of lines of coke, and he's in a lot of stress. He's got a stressful job, and I know deep down he loves me, but he's coked out every night. That's excuse making for your spouse or your partner, and I think it's one to really be aware of. Now, are there any other questions? Part of the problem with my switchboard is that if I've taken somebody off of live, the question remains. So I don't know if they have a second question. It's a limitation on Blog Talk Radio, but there are several callers. If anybody has another question, this might be a good time to voice that question. Nope. Okay. The next thing I think is really important to look at is whether the two of you share compatible visions for a committed relationship, or do your respective ideas about love and partnership conflict in core ways? I've worked with so many couples where one person's idea of marriage is something kind of, I don't know, maybe it's, if I'm being kind, I would say 16th century, and another person's idea about marriage is 21st century. And they have a very, very different vision for how much sharing there needs to be, how much power sharing there needs to be, how much together time, how much negotiation, how much they listen to each other. And this is what people are talking about when they talk about compatibility. Very often people think of it as just sexual compatibility, but do you have a compatible vision for what your relationship needs to look like? I think everybody's had the experience with friends, some friends you let go of because what they thought was an okay friendship is certainly not your idea about it. Well, I'm encouraging listeners and anybody who listens to the recorded version of this show to think about that. Are you on the same page? And I don't mean exactly the same, but do they fit? Your visions fit? Another one on this theme of the fit is do you have shared values regarding what living a good life means? Or is one of you satisfied with something that to the other looks very unambitious or very uncreative or not very spiritual or not very connected socially? What are your ideas about what a good life needs to look like? And if you are in some basic conflict about that, I would say you may be trying to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear and sorely, sorely deluding yourself again in the name of love. This one, I see this one a lot in my practice where and often it comes out around certain life stages like retirement. One person's idea of a really peachy retirement is to sit in their chair and watch ball games or shop. Or yak on the phone or just hang out at home. And another person's idea of retirement is to maintain health, to be vital, to see the world, to be expansive. And I've seen a lot of marriages break up where people are in their 60s. They've been together 40 years and they realize there's not a whole lot of more time happening. And so time's running out, and we do not have the same vision for what the rest of our life looks like. I think people hit a wall around that. So, again, I would invite you to look at that. Does the picture feel like it basically fits? And that doesn't mean that you have to have all the same interests, but does the basic picture feel like it's pretty well aligned? I've worked with people where one person was very into service and they took a lot of joy and pleasure and meaning from serving others and doing volunteer work, et cetera, being part of a community of some kind of social or environmental change. And the partner criticized them all the time. They thought, you think you're Pollyanna? What's going on? You know, the world's a lousy place. You know, just let it go. And not only was there not a kind of linkage there or an instinctness, but there was something that systematically undermine the other person's vision. So you're never going to be fully aligned on every front, but do you feel like your partner supports it? And do you support your partner's vision for a happy life? And are you well enough aligned? Again, are there any questions? I see here's another question. Hello, caller. What's your name?
Yes, I'm Daniel from Connecticut.
Hi, Daniel.
You know, I'm listening to this and I'm thinking that, you know, love in relationships evolve from puppy love when you're a little kid to, you know, more intense sexuality and infatuation as you grow older and become independent from your parents or whatever force there might be. And we kind of evolve and things become more monetary in life. They become a little more stale in relation to our age and, you know, our passion on a sexual level possibly. And we have children, and all of those things added up can really kind of bash a relationship to shreds. And I think people oftentimes have an image of what true love is as something from their past rather than the reality of the present and the evolution of a different type of love. And I wonder how often you see that happen where, you know, people are dreaming of something that really probably can't be at a certain age, and how much monetary issues affect relationships in terms of dreams and wishes and the inability to accomplish them as a result of just not having enough money.
You're bringing up, it's a complicated question, but it's a great question. There's always a waning of passion and a waning of what we call the enchantment phase. Everyone is on their best behavior in the early stage of a relationship. I've almost never met a couple who said we were miserable from square one. And there's a lot that's been written about the stages of a relationship and how inevitably with familiarity and stress and kids and financial stressors and disappointments, how life sort of slings arrows at you. Of course there's going to be something that doesn't feel quite as fresh and vital as the early part of the relationship. But I'm not talking about that early kind of enchantment and romance. That inevitably transforms into something that feels a little bit less vital and less intense. And there are always, you know, I think the challenge for every couple is to try to keep the interest alive and things feeling vital and connection feeling vital. But if there is an illusion or an expectation that it's going to be the way it was entirely in the beginning, that's delusional. It's the only couples where I see that happen are couples where there's a huge amount of denial. And basically what they do is they have loads of sex. They avoid conflict and they kind of patch it up with, they're just great compatibly sexually, and they sweep things under the rug, they avoid and deny, and they're just not rooted in reality. But for the average couple, those things do transform into something that generally looks more conflictual and more, a little bit more worn out, a little bit more tired, and the task for everybody is to nurture your relationship and to pay attention to it. I talk all the time about being intentional about your relationship, and I'll share the fact that my husband and I have some of these really hokey rituals that are very connective, like walking in the garden and ooing and aahing, or thanking each other for making the bed or for creating a fire in the fireplace. Things like that where we try to be mindful about ways that we appreciate each other and we love each other, and mindful about activities that foster a more loving stance. In this show, though, you know, and again, that could be another whole show, how you nurture a relationship. I'm looking at six basic factors that, if they are present or absent, are real alarms to pay attention to. You know, that's something, you know, I could add a seventh. Whether or not there's any co-commitment to nurturing the relationship, keeping it fresh. So maybe I misnamed the program, the six factors. It probably should be 12, just for the purposes I kind of condensed it. But do you see what I mean? Have you personally experienced what you're talking about, where things get kind of worn out because of the slings and arrows of life, and there's a kind of holding on to something kind of mythical about the past?
Yeah, to some degree. I think I at times mourn my past in relation to the difficulties of life in the present. I think, as you say, communication is of the essence, and that people maybe need, myself included, to learn how to communicate honestly about all numbers of things, and sometimes maybe hear that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you're bringing up probably number eight that should have been in the show, communication. And is there a co-commitment to talking to each other about not only little things but important things? Or does one partner or both partners, do both of you avoid the elephant in the living room? Because there are some things that can be worked out just by distracting and redirecting or sublimating. That's sometimes fine. But there are things that really require coming to the table and being willing to share your hearts and to say what you need and to negotiate and to listen to each other. And that's about communication. Now, that one, the good news with that is that, and I've just written a book about it, but I'm not going to plug my book yet because it's not out yet. I've just written a book about how there are skills involved in communication. And the good news is that if there's a willingness, a lot of communication is—it's not only goodwill and it's a motivation, but a lot of the communication piece is about learning skills. Most of us did not learn how to really talk to each other in our families. I know in my family, the loudest one—it was a shouting match—and the loudest one got the most airtime, or the most symptomatic one got the most airtime. Whoever performed best or sort of showed the most signs of distress got airtime one way or the other. But that's a terrible way to talk. It was a shout fest. And, there are all different kinds of family styles, but I think the good news about that is that it those are skills that can be developed. So does that kind of answer your question, caller?
Yeah, that's very helpful.
Good. I'm glad. Now, moving along here, we have a few more. Another factor to consider is, and this is huge, to look at whether you with any regularity are experiencing feelings of abandonment, rejection, disrespect, lack of safety, loneliness, rage, despair, anxiety, shame, or inequity. And those are just the ones I thought about. The list could go on and on. But the key here is with any regularity. So if you are feeling essentially really crappy in your relationship, not feeling respected, not feeling a sense of commitment, feeling alone, and disrespected is a really big one. If you don't feel a sense of emotional safety any of these. But if that kind of characterizes the climate of your relationship and your internal experience, I would say you need to take a second look at your relationship. And if you were saying to yourself, well, you know, it feels pretty crummy most of the time, but I love him or I love her, and I know somewhere deep down in there he loves me, I would say you're feeding yourself a big rationale, because these feelings and these experiences are, when they're happening with regularity, that's the key word, are not signs of a loving, healthy relationship. They happen at times in all our relationships. You know, I know one of the jokes that I share with clients is that there's at some point in, probably in each week, I say to myself, I cannot imagine being married to my husband for the rest of my life. I must be crazy. I have moments of that. And it may be around any one of these things, but the key is that it's momentary. And something happens that's corrective and reparative and reminds me, oh, that was just a bad hair day, or we were just having a really bad day, but it wasn't a bad 3 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 months, 10 years. It's not essentially all of these things with regularity. So that's something that I would say is really key to look at. And are there any other questions at this point? Because I have one other factor that I would like to address. Caller, did you have a question? Your question mark was still on. I didn't know if you had another question.
Oh. Are you no? Are you there?
Yeah.
What if you're feeling all of those with regularity? Rejection, rage, despair, anxiety, shame, not respected, lonely, and not heard.
I would say your relationship is in trouble. You may be in a dead relationship, and I think it's time to look at it. You may be kind of torturing yourself in a relationship that is either abusive. Certainly some of these things are abusive. It's certainly not a happy scene, and it's not good for you. It's not good for you psychologically. It's not good for you physically. It will begin to take its toll. You see that as people age. And what I would say is, if you're experiencing it and your partner's oblivious to it, drag them. Drag them into couples work. Give them an ultimatum. Let them know, this: I will not tolerate this. We need to deal with this. I'm very, very unhappy. And if you say you love me, then it's not a loving thing for you to just insist on the maintenance of these things. And that's probably the most dire thing that I have to say, that sometimes it's the handwriting's on the wall. It's all around you. It's time to just look at it. And sometimes, if your partner refuses to deal with these things, stonewalls you about them, it may be time to let go. And I don't like saying that to couples that I work with. I don't like saying that to friends. Sometimes there's no pulse left, and you're hanging on to an illusion or a dream about something that may have been way back when, but it just died. So pay attention to whether or not there's a pulse in the relationship. And these are indicators of whether there's a pulse, if you experience these with regularity. Does that feel like it addresses the question?
Absolutely. It's very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. My final one, and that I had on my list, you know, things to evaluate, critical factors, was, do you need to be medicated in order to stay in the relationship? And i.e., are you on antidepressants? Are you over drinking? Are you compulsively shopping? Are you overworking? Are you in essentially chronic escape mode, one way or the other? And all of those are forms of psychological exits. And what I would say is that it would be really important for you to look at that, because what you're doing is damping down your experience. You're turning against yourself in order to be in the relationship, and that's not a good thing. It's very toxic. If you're doing these things with any regularity, taking drugs or drinking or any kind of compulsive activity, where you're checking out and you're numbing, that's basically what it is. What you're doing is avoiding the elephant in the living room, and the elephant in the living room may be the dead relationship. The meds may help you. I have a colleague and friend who says this a lot. You may be avoiding immediate pain, but sacrificing long-term gain. So it may help you get through the day and the week and get through something that's happening with your kid or work or whatever, but the elephant in the living room may be the fact that you're in a really bad place. And my best recommendation to you is, if you're experiencing any one of these or a number of these with regularity, pay attention to it more, because you are not helping yourself or the relationship if you're numbing out. You're just managing, and managing is not the same thing as dealing. Are there? Well, I have one other thing, and then I'll take some questions just to make sure I can get through to the end. What I think is most important is that if in your relationship you generally, just to sum it up, you don't feel happy, you don't feel energized or respected, with a sense of true committed teamwork, you may want to reevaluate the, quote, love factor that you've been hanging on to. And if you decide that it's not looking good, you may want to examine what your investment is, as I said, in staying in a relationship where you're not cherished. Why don't you feel deserving of real love? I really encourage listeners to explore that. Figure that one out on your own or with professional help. And I think if you can figure that one out, that will be the beginning of a very, very different kind of life for you, because you won't just be kind of hobbling along day by day making do. And again, I want to qualify this. I want to let our listeners know that we all make do in various ways. There are trade-offs and things that we put up with that feel crappy in our marriages or our long-term partnerships. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a pervasive experience of something that just is really feels toxic. So the best advice I could give you is, if you're in one of those relationships, drag your butt into individual therapy if your partner refuses, and look at it and be conscious about it. Then you'll be able to make more conscious choices about whether you stay or you leave or whatever you do, what you're prepared to do, what you have energy to do, what you feel like you have resources to do. If you're lacking resources, what do you need to do to access those resources? You will make much better choices if you're making conscious choices. Anyway, I can't believe it. The show is over. We're just about out of time, but there's probably time for maybe one brief other question if anybody has it. And there is a caller with a question. Hello, caller.
Hello, Susan. My name is Laura, and I wanted to thank you very
Hi.
Much. Hello. For this very interesting presentation and these different critical factors that I guess so many of us can look at some point in our relationship. My question is this, because I'm listening to the callers and the questions and your feedback. As a therapist, do you then not believe or think that every relationship is fixable if both parties involved are willing to work at it?
I think if both partners are willing to work at it and are open and curious about their part in the problems and the solutions, I think there's a vastly bigger pool of possibilities. But let's say you're both willing to work at it, and one of the places you get to, for instance, is that your visions, you're willing to work at some of the other stuff, but your core visions for a happy life or your core values aren't well aligned, with the best of intentions, you may be trying to make a pig fly. Do you know what
right.
I'm saying? So I guess the quick answer is that I do not believe that every relationship, contrary to what you'll hear on in some of the self-help books, that every relationship can be fixed or saved or changed. I don't believe that. And I do think the odds are just about 100% better if each partner is willing to come to the table and work together on it. But sometimes what you get to is that you're trying to make a fit out of something. You're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, even with
right.
the best of intentions and you working on it.
Great, great. Thank you very much. Very
okay.
interesting. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. I'm glad. I hope you know it was helpful. And I want to thank all our listeners and callers. I mean, you asked some very very incisive questions, and you certainly helped me think about things that I haven't included. I also want to thank other people who have tuned in. There are another number of other people who have tuned in who didn't ask questions. I hope you all enjoyed the show and maybe learned a thing or two. What I'd like to tell you is that for a limited time only, I will be offering a one-hour phone consultation, a number of those, for anyone wanting a more in-depth exploration of this issue. I'll be using my original article, Love is Not Enough. So this show is based on that article. And together we'll help you hopefully get to a better read on the strengths and the possibilities in your relationship, or if it seems that you may be wasting time. So if you're interested in that, for pricing and availability, you can contact me at my email address, which is couplecenter@gmail.com. That's couplecenter@gmail.com. Or just call my Portsmouth office at 603-431-7131. And we could talk about what's available and whether or not, you know, your particular situation and whether it feels like it might be useful to have one of those consultations. Okay? Anyway, tune into my next episode, which will be, let's see, it's Wednesday, September 19th. I can't believe we're moving into the fall already, but we are. It's going to be Wednesday, September 19th at 8:30 p.m. I will be announcing the topic and the co-host soon. I'm quite sure I'm going to have a co-host. I have some people in mind. And I will let you know. I'll advertise it on Twitter and all of the social media. And hopefully you'll join me. So good night, everyone. And I hope you all enjoy the rest of the summer. And I hope you look at these things, set the stage for a more conscious, intentional relationship with more possibilities. Take care and good night.